Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae on News Talk.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, rating. Coming up on this week's program, we are going to be talking about the building of a robotic esophagus by researchers in UCT, because apparently the process by which we swallow our food is a lot more complicated than you might think. Why we would need a robotic esophagus, though, I'm not quite sure. Let's find out. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of your comments at the end of the program. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more breaking stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Shane Bergen, physicist at UCT, and double Dr. Lara Dungan, immunologist and medic. You're both very welcome. And we're going to start off talking about a story that's quite interesting, because it's about quantum. And essentially, we finally know where people are.
Yeah, physicists love asking the basic questions, but we don't know what the vast majority of the universe is made of. And we actually don't even know where things are with any degree of huge precision. We really do not do well when it comes to explaining things simply. But recently at the Global Physics Summit in Denver, Colorado, a piece of interesting work was published or pre-published. It's on the archive. And it's work from Boulder in Colorado. And it's talking about using quantum science to be able to accurately tell where a person or a thing is. Now, listeners are probably wondering, why the hell does this matter, right? Surely we have enough precision to know where people are. It matters greatly if issues of security are involved. So you imagine somebody who has, the button for a nuclear device, and you need to know exactly where they are. If they're pushing the button, or if you have a tech person who's interested in knowing where sort of trading is going on, these sorts of things matter, and people are willing to invest in the technology associated with it. So what happens here is you have a corridor in Boulder, Colorado, 200 meters long. You have three people involved. Two of them are called verifiers. They're at either extreme, and in the middle you have somebody called a prover. And that prover's whereabouts is the thing we're trying to find out. And so they connected them all using a kind of complicated equipment. And what they were able to do was to use quantum mechanics to tell exactly where the prover in the middle is. So what happens is one verifier at one end sends something called an entangled photon to the person that whose whereabouts they're trying to learn about. So entanglement is the quantum property that we're interested in here. And what you're able to do is you're able to share the entangled photon between one party and the unknown party. And they're in what's called a superposition. So it means that they're kind of in this many states at once phase until one of the two parties observes the thing they're looking at. So this is the collapsing of the uncertainty to a point of certainty. So if the verifier looks at the entangled photon and observes something called its polarization, which is just effectively the orientation of this particle, immediately the person in the middle is able to do the same thing, and they can relay this information to one another. So what the entanglement is the quantum property that we're interested in here. So what happens is you can take two quantum particles, effectively a piece of light, and you can mix them up in such a way that the property of one immediately affects the other, even if they're separated out over a huge distance. And so when they're in this mixed up quantum entangled state, both exist in a blurry many states at once phase until you observe one of them.
It's like you give each particle like a bit of it of each other, and they know what's going on about each other all this at the same time. It's like two obsessed teenagers or something. When you separate them, they know exactly what's happening all the time with the other person.
Absolutely. And they're in a cloud of possibilities, right, until you observe one of them. And the act of looking at one of the entangled particles immediately affects the behavior of the other one. So if you look at one, you know the exact properties of the other one, even though they're separated by a huge distance. And so that allows you to sort of to move from the quantum state to the non-quantum state. And from the point of view of the thing we're interested in here, you're allowed to, or now able to, tell the whereabouts of a person So
how does it do that bit? Because like we've talked about entangled particles on the program before, and that just is one of these weird quirks of nuclear physics when we talk about anything that goes beyond the subatomic size, just weird stuff happens. So I'm just going to park that bit. How do they use this to identify GPS location?
So what they're able to do is they're able to, sort of dig into quantum physics here. The only way of knowing where these people are at such speed will be through quantum mechanics. So if you were to use non-quantum ways, it would be much slower and there would be a far weaker correlation.
And has it something to do with the direction from which this entangled information is coming from or something?
Yeah, and that's why you have the person whose whereabouts you're trying to find in the middle.
And you need two people.
Yeah.
You need two people.
So you're kind of correlating. Now, it only works along a line at the moment. You'd need a third one if you wanted to try and understand somebody's whereabouts in two dimensions.
In fairness, that was a tricky one. So I think we covered quite well. Thank you, Shane. Lara, our second story has to do with oysters.
Yeah, this seems so simple now by comparison, but this is a lovely bit of research that was just published by Trinity. And so what they found was if they use oyster shells, so oyster shells, which when I first read the story, I was like, is there really that many oyster shells out there? But apparently millions of tons of oyster shells are discarded as a result of aquaculture every year. So it is a very significant waste product and nothing is made with it or done with it. And what these researchers in Trinity did is they used it in water, in, for instance, water in rivers, and water that is a natural part of our water cycle. But they found that all water, that all water is contaminated with rare earth metals. So what rare earth metals are, metals that are rare, although they are rare compared with other metals, they're not extremely rare. So these are unusual metals. There are to say the things like lanthanum, cerium, yttrium, and they are all used in the production of things like electric vehicles, electronics, wind turbines. And they are leached out in some of the processes in mining, refining, manufacturing, and they contaminate waterways. And what these researchers in Trinity did is they found that if you use oyster shells just laid in the water, then the rare earth metals are actually able to incorporate into the oyster shell. So the shells aren't alive. They're not filtering out the metals actively, but it's a chemical process whereby the calcium carbonate, which is what's in the shell already, is changed by a chemical process. And these rare metals are incorporated into the shell. So a shell that at the start of the process is pure, beautiful white, by the end of it is becomes brown and is covered in all these chemicals. So it's a way to pull them out of the water, but a very, very natural process that already uses a waste product. So really interesting way to sort of clean up waterways, as it were.
Right. The process you've described reminds me of osseointegration, which my dentist Justin is fascinated with. So osseointegration is the process by which your bone fuses to just titanium. Titanium fuses just to your bone. It actually integrates within your bone completely in a way that no other metal does. That's why we can have implants. But I didn't realize that oysters could filter water if they weren't alive. So that's kind of cool because there's a lot of dead oysters out there. And you know, when it comes to just people eating oysters, we just throw them in the compost typically, but they clearly have a purpose.
Yeah, but if you don't think of it as filtration, so filtration, I suppose, is like sieving. If you imagine a sieve, this is more like if you've got, say, sugar dissolved in water and you want to pull it back out again. So it's literally a chemical process that takes these rare earth minerals and solidifies them into the oyster shell. So it's not even, the oyster's not alive. It's not actively doing this. It's just a chemical process that can just naturally happen, easy, cheap, and quick. Now, whether or not you can then take these rare earth metals back out again and use them for industry, they don't know. They haven't looked into how feasible that is financially or whether it's doable. But it is very interesting to clean up waterways and to remove these metal contaminants.
Is it, I mean, how do you harvest this stuff to put it where it needs to be? Is that how they talked about that?
Yeah, so they're talking about using it in basically water filtration processes. So where you would be filtering water anyway, you would maybe have a bed of oyster shells and the water could sit for hours or days. But it wouldn't be the kind of thing that you could practically, you know, throw in the bed of every single river. But there are definitely places where it could be useful. Maybe as water is coming out of a processing plant, you could have it move through these oyster shells. I've just come up with this genius idea there myself. But that could be a way to make sure that you get it where it's really, really needed. Mm.
Our third story, Shane, has to do with lightning.
Yes, a lightning bolt on Earth is about a gigajoule of energy, which is enough to power 200 homes, which is the standard unit of energy, 200 homes for 1 hour. It's quite a lot. It really is. Now, interestingly, the Earth isn't the only place that has lightning. You can see it on other planets, and indeed the Juno mission that has been going around Jupiter since 2016 has observed lots of lightning on Jupiter. Jupiter's famous for having huge storms. The fact that it's a gas giant and the fact that there's no land masses on it means the weather on Jupiter is completely uninterrupted as it goes around the planet. And you can have storms that last centuries, like the Big Eye that we're all familiar with. There is lightning there as well. And we know that the lightning on Jupiter is bright. It's thought that it's maybe more than 100 times more powerful than Earth's lightning. And scientists have been trying to figure out why. Perhaps it's even up as high as 1 million times more powerful. And we're trying to figure these things out. So what they did here was they used a combination of very cool equipment, including the Juno Observer, but also the Hubble telescope. So they're able to focus in on a single storm, which is tricky because there are so many of them, and then look at measurements to try and measure the power of the lightning bolts as they strike. And they've been able to do that. And what they're in this paper adding is sort of ideas as to what it is that makes the lightning much stronger. So on the Earth, thunderstorms happen because moisture, water vapor at the surface level rises on a warm day. And as it does so, it condenses into water, into droplets, or indeed it goes further and turns into hail or ice. And these become electrically charged, and you can have a massive amount of potential difference of voltage that's set up between them. So you have pieces of, it's like rubbing, you know, the balloon off your hair, right? You get this kind of static that's built up on it. And this happens on a huge scale with water vapor condensing into droplets, or indeed with ice crystals, and you're effectively setting up this massive electric field. Eventually, it cracks, right? You know, the amount of voltage exceeds what the system can hold, and it flashes. And those things can go from cloud to cloud, or they can strike the Earth. And so far, so good, right? So what happens on Earth is our atmosphere is predominantly made out of nitrogen. So it's easy for the thing to rise and convect. On Jupiter, it's really different. Jupiter is made out of hydrogen predominantly. So it behaves very, very differently. So what they're saying is that it takes an awful lot more energy for a cloud to form on Jupiter and for the conditions for lightning to be set up. So by the time you get to kind of discharge or lightning, a lot more energy has been put into the system, and therefore the lightning bolt is much, much, much stronger than it is on the Earth. This is very cool. And also, maybe just to add, we still don't know an awful lot about how lightning works on the Earth.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if we could find a way of reproducing those environmental variables in a controllable way, like, that sounds like a lot of energy. That sounds like that would be useful, particularly in today's age.
Yeah, or you could become a supervillain, like from X-Men, exactly, control lightning, storm.
So there's two uses here. Our final story, Lara, has to do with wound healing. We've been talking a lot about this over the last while. What's this story?
This is cool. Actually, I really like this. This has just been published in Cell, which is a very prestigious journal, and it came from Harvard. And what these scientists did is they were looking in mice. So obviously you cannot study wound healing in human embryos. It's completely unethical. But There are certain clinical observations that have been made because, as we spoke about not too long ago, fetuses do have surgery. And what's been found observationally rather than in clinical trials is that a fetus heals without a scar. So it heals perfectly. And this is quite fascinating because even within a few days after the baby is born or a baby is born, if a baby is injured or has surgery, they will scar. Now, small babies will scar a lot less than adults will. So it is a bit of a spectrum, but scars will form on almost any baby that has been born. So they looked at mice, and what they did was they were able to effectively, cause injury to embryos at different stages, plus baby mice straight after they'd been born. And they found that there's a pretty clear cutoff. So if the injury is caused anywhere up to 3 days prior to birth, it will effectively heal without a scar. And by the time a baby is 5 days old, the baby mice, they will scar. And they wanted to know why this is, because
Stem cells.
It's actually not quite stem cells. It's always stem cells.
Dang it.
The reason that we scar evolutionarily is because in the past, you didn't really need perfect, complete skin to regrow. We didn't care about aesthetics. We cared about not getting infection and not dying when we were cavemen. So the faster a wound closed over and healed in a strong manner, the better you were going to be evolutionary. And that's why we scar, as far as we can tell. But these days, we don't really have those exact same issues. So what they found was that one of the issues that stopped these wounds healing back into perfect skin, because skin is complex, it's very layered, there's lots of different cell types, is that nerves came in and hyper-innervated or covered this scar tissue or this wound in nerves. And the nerves were stopping the other cells growing properly. So the fibroblasts were then able to make collagen, which makes a scar. So that's what a scar is. And they found that these nerves were being called in by a chemical. Now, the chemical was called CXCL12, so it's complicated enough. But the point is that this is a chemical that your body produces to tell nerves to come into the wound. Come, come, come. And this was done because we wanted to scar. Back in the day, we wanted to scar. So what they did was they blocked this CXCL12. They blocked the nerves from coming in, and they found they were able to significantly reduce scarring, and the wounds were able to create much more well-orchestrated and normal-looking skin. And the other thing they used was Botox or botulinum toxin, because we know that that stops nerves from moving. It's a nerve blocker. And that also was able to improve the healing. Now, people have used Botox in wounds before, not for this specific reason, but more to try and paralyze the muscles around a wound to try and help it to heal better. And it has only really shown moderate improvement in wound healing, but it hasn't been used for this exact reason. So maybe the timing is different, or maybe there's another way this can be used. But if you could use something as simple as Botox to inject it into a large wound to help to create better wound healing or reduce scar formation, it would be really, really interesting, really exciting, and quite an easy fix. So it's really interesting basic research.
And cave women.
Cave people. The cave person.
And cave women.
Don't
come on the show and say when we were cavemen, and don't also say cave women.
I am so sorry. And you are holding women up. You are the virtue of womanhood. I'm sorry, Jonathan.
If there was a medal going, you would be so deserving.
I wouldn't refuse it. I would be honored. And so the mechanism by which you can sort of trigger this prevention of nerve activity, like they think that that's doable, and that the benefits of the scars are not necessary?
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, like, scarring these days isn't quite what it used to be in caveman and cavewoman eras. I mean, you know, we have a lot more time to heal into healthy skin. So this is a process that our genes basically turn it off. There's a lot of genes that we have when we're an embryo, and it gets turned off as soon as we're born. And this is another one of those. So if this is the correct method, it should be easy enough to manipulate and hopefully could lead to reduced scar formation.
Wow. Well, Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Laura Dungan, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much. The art of swallowing is probably not something that really gets you thinking very often, because it's an automatic process that, unless something bad is happening, you don't really notice. But a team at UCD has created a world-first robotic esophagus known as the RoboGullet that could transform how we understand everyday swallowing. Why? Well, that's what we're here to find out. Dr. Owen O'Carville is Associate Professor in Biomedical Engineering at UCD and one of the people behind RoboGullet. Owen, let's start off with some basic biology, if that's okay. Well, what exactly is our esophagus and what does it do? Is it a fairly straightforward thing to swallow something?
Hi, Jonathan. Yeah, so swallowing takes place in our esophagus, our food pipe. And as you said, it's something we really take for granted until something goes wrong. So sometimes we think of it as this passive pipe and might have the idea that gravity helps us swallow bits of food after we chew them up, and gravity certainly helps. But in reality, there's this intricate interplay of two muscle groups, circumferential muscle groups or circular muscle groups that squeeze the tube, and then these longitudinal muscles that are along the length of the esophagus, and they locally shorten and lengthen effectively the esophagus, and that helps with our swallowing mechanism.
And is it sort of like a, you know, when you sort of squeeze some cake mix through a piping thing, is it sort of like a squeeze as it pushes down? Is it more complicated than that? And do the muscles just go in unison in sequence? Is that the idea?
Yeah. So if we think about squeezing a cake mix or something like that, what we tend to do is we squeeze and then we push. And that kind of second pushing or pulling action, that's the bit that others really haven't been able to replicate successfully in a laboratory setting before. So it's how these muscles interact with each other and how the nerves fire. That's key to us having this peristaltic motion or smooth movement of, if you think about the different shapes and sizes of things that we swallow, peristalsis is all about smooth pushing of that bolus or piece of food through our esophagus.
Yeah, Mary Roach has this amazing book called Gulp. If you're interested in the science of food, she's an amazing writer, and she's written this incredible book called Gulp that talks about all of the research that's gone into swallowing, tasting, and experiencing food. And that's the place I first heard the term bolus, which is sort of like a nugget of food that that goes from the top of the back of your mouth down to the esophagus. That's sort of a lump of food. Is that what a bolus is, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So this bolus travels through, presumably lubricated by saliva and other. Are there other things in the esophagus, or is it just saliva that lubricates the journey of the bolus to your stomach?
Yeah. So that's an important another really important part of this is that you have that muscle function acting in this. This kind of active moving pipe, but you've also got that lubricious layer on the inside. So that's a combination, as you said, of saliva and kind of a mucosal or mucus-based lining on the esophagus. So that helps keep the friction low and keep things moving along.
And what happens, what's going on when it goes wrong? So when someone chokes, for example, is it the size of the bolus? Is it the lack of, that there's not enough room, not enough lubrication? Is it always very obvious what's happening when someone chokes?
Yeah. So I suppose in a general, with maybe choking, you could have maybe blockage of the windpipe or the food, you could have food going down the wrong way, as we say, and it could block off your windpipe. But you can also have that nasty sensation of something stuck in your food pipe, essentially. And that condition, if you have it repeatedly, is known as dysphagia, which is essentially difficulty in swallowing.
Right.
And that affects 1 in 5 of us globally. So it's a massive issue. And then as you get over 60, that number goes up to about 50% of people have difficulty swallowing.
The process of this is really interesting, right? So you're talking about the difficulty in swallowing. That obviously in the reason those numbers go up is because of various reasons, but also things like stroke and other conditions and diseases that make swallowing difficult. The process of making a RoboGullet, because it's so mechanical, I'm just wondering what was the thinking behind creating an artificial esophagus? What are you hoping to learn? And what else guided your design of this mechanism?
Yeah, so working on this, so this work was carried out by a really talented PhD student called Sean Kilroy. And working with Sean, initially we were looking at developing a new type of stent coating. So people might be familiar with stents used normally in our vascular system, and they're these scaffolds that prop open and keep a vessel open. But they're also used in the esophagus, primarily, unfortunately, for people with esophageal cancer. And there you have a tissue going in, so you're looking to put the stent there to stop the esophagus from re-blocking. But the big problem with these stents is that they tend to move or migrate. And we had a frustration that there were no good models for us to test our new coating that was developed. So myself and Sean started working with an expert group in Harvard and MIT led by Dr. Giovanni Traverso. And Gio has this really cool lab where they test loads of smart swallowable pills with microneedles and things like that. But again, he shared this frustration that there was a lack of appropriate models to test these things. So it's really the need for, we want to develop better medical devices, but we thought that the benchtop models weren't suitable at the moment.
Right. So the RoboGullet is trying to address that problem of being able to test different physical medication, for example, or other the processes of what happens inside the gullet. Now, presumably, this isn't just made of metal and rubber, because that's in no way a good analog for the human environment. So how do you make this a good model for esophageal action?
Yeah, so we use the principles of something called soft robotics, and that's been kind of a movement the last while to get away from rigid metals. But we are actually using, it's a silicone materials, two types of silicone, and they're actually a rubber-like material, but much softer than the rubber that you would find in the tires of your car. But similarly to the tires in your car, we're pressurizing chambers that we're using to simulate these muscle groups. So we've one set of chambers that Sean built on the inside, that when we inflate those, they simulate the circular or circumferential muscles, and one set of tubes and chambers on the outside where we simulate the muscle group, the longitudinal muscles that fire along the length of the esophagus.
Right, but didn't I read something about actually using a pig's esophagus as well?
Yeah, part of our goal. So first part was getting the muscle function right. But then that other really important property of the esophagus, we talked about its frictional properties and its compliance. We turned to native tissue. So we used the lining of a pig's esophagus obtained from food grade sources. And we're able to put that on the inside of the tube. So this is what's called kind of a biohybrid system. Mm. So bits of biological tissue and bits of, in our case, synthetic muscle groups to try and replicate as best we can what a human esophagus is going to function like.
So I was really interested in that. That was one of the reasons I really wanted to speak with you, because I think it's you know, it's a really interesting innovation to use, you know, real biological esophagus with this mechanical device that you've used to try and recreate what happens when we swallow something. But how do you keep that tissue alive and healthy and acting like a real esophagus when obviously it's no longer connected to the pig?
Yeah. So there's ways of partially fixing the tissue or pouring artificial saliva on top of it or artificial mucus. But what we did, we tried to work with it as fresh as possible, and we just used it for a single day testing at a time.
Like it is, you know, what I love about this program is you just hear about what scientists are doing, because, you know, this stereotype that we got when we were kids of scientists in lab coats and doing very serious things with, you know, with chemicals, and here you are using a pig's esophagus as a once-off sort of skin for a mechanical machine. It's just kind of it's mad, and also a little bit gross, and also very cool. Like it's all of those things, right, at the same time. Talk to me about some of the things you've tested. So you did something with Greek yogurt. What was that about?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, we started off looking to develop this model so that we'd be able to test better devices in the gastrointestinal tract or in the esophagus. But once it was built and we started working with clinical collaborators, we figured out that we could use this maybe for two other purposes. One is to improve the diagnosis of different types of swallowing disorders. One of those is achalasia. And the second thing is for these patients, there's dietary recommendations. So a severe form of achalasia is where the sphincter or the valve in your esophagus essentially goes into spasm and closes up. So it stops the food from going down. So something for patients who are unlucky enough to develop this, their doctor might recommend, oh, you should probably eat Greek yogurt. It'll be a good source of nutrition. And they might say, you should stir that. But it's also a non-Newtonian fluid.
Greek yogurt is non-Newtonian.
Yeah. So if we stir it, its mechanical properties change a lot. So we start vibrating the material and it becomes more fluid-like. So Sean did quite a simple experiment. He set up the RoboGullet model, simulating one of these disease states of achalasia. And then he poured the yogurt in through the esophagus without stirring it. And then in a separate experiment, he stirred it first and poured it through. And he was able to show quite definitively that if you stir the yogurt first, it's going to move through your esophagus more easily and cause you fewer issues.
I think that's great. And one of the things that sort of might be missed is that idea that this RoboGullet can mimic the condition of someone's esophagus that isn't working properly. And I think that's really a key part of this research, that it could actually help you figure out those things, the recommendations that people make based on maybe common sense or, you know, anecdotal or, you know, their patient's history. But, you know, in terms of research on each of these things, it's hard to get good, solid research. And I think that's a really cool thing that you've built, this RoboGullet. And it looks like something from a sci-fi movie. It's this big stack it looks like a 3D printed plastic with loads of tubes going into it. It looks very cool.
Yeah. And one of the cool things we can do with it, so we mentioned about that condition, achalasia. Normally, it's not really that well understood how it progresses or if it progresses from one form to another. So the way that happens clinically at the moment, if this has to be diagnosed, they put a pressure catheter down your esophagus. So you have to swallow a catheter that goes down your esophagus. And this has a load of pressure probes along its length. And then maybe if you're to progress to another form of achalasia, they'll redo this test. But in the lab, with our model, we can simulate these conditions and see what muscle groups are firing. So we can maybe start to even improve not just diagnosis, but understanding of how achalasia as a disease progresses.
Very cool stuff. That is Owen O'Carville. He's Associate Professor in Biomedical Engineering at UCD. Owen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jonathan.
So it's time to look back at some of your comments from last week's program. Jesse Smith from the University of Cambridge was our guest. Someone says, why don't all planes leave contrails? Well, according to Jesse, it depends on the humidity of the air. There are patches of air that are particularly humid, and then if the jet plane goes through it, it's more likely to leave these ice crystals. And you can actually avoid that by flying higher or lower, was her evidence. Charlotte says, do contrails behave differently at night? I wonder to what extent they're influenced by heat and sunlight. That is a good question. I mean, if we're talking about reflecting heat and the sun is not shining on the earth, I would imagine it's reduced, of course. But to what extent, I'm not quite sure. Finally, Jack says, do different types of fuel or engines produce different contrails? My understanding is it's mostly all the same sort of a fuel. We haven't really nailed a green aviation fuel yet. And it is water vapor that is coming out as a byproduct. So I would imagine yes, Jack, would be the answer. That's it from us on this week's episode. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to Maurizio Sullivan producing, Rory Galvin on podcast, and Hugo da Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sunday from midday. News Talk. Conversation that counts.